Our reading this morning is from Matthew chapter 10, verses 16 to 20. I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Be on your guard. You'll be handed over to the local councils and be flogged in the synagogues. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. But when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you will be given what to say, for it will not be you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. This is the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
First of all, thanks, Yvonne, for your reading. I notice you were on welcoming this morning. I understand you'll be counting later as well. So thank you for your service to the house. So in the second letter to Corinthians, the Apostle Paul talks of taking captive every thought, making it obedient to Christ. So with that in mind, I feel somewhat authorized to begin this morning with one of the great masterpieces of modern culture, Shrek. Most of you will likely know it's a story about an antisocial ogre named Shrek who lives in a swamp, and he's provoked into action when a bunch of magical creatures are dumped into the swamp on the instructions of the ruler of a nearby kingdom, who decides to banish them from his realm. So Shrek sets off, accompanied by a feisty donkey, to confront the ruler, and they end up striking a deal. Shrek rescues a princess named Fiona from the clutches of a dragon so the king can marry her, and the king in return will return the swamp to its formerly peaceful state. So the thought I'd like to take captive from this movie occurs at a moment between the rescue taking place and the meeting with the king. They're staying in an old building overnight, and while Donkey and Fiona are inside, she reveals to him something shocking. She's had a spell cast on her, right? It transforms her into an ogre every night and then back into a human princess every day. So meanwhile, Shrek is outside, and if we could have the first image, like sort of showing up hopefully clearly for you guys. Yep, good. So Shrek's outside while this happens, and he ends up only hearing part of what they're talking about. As a result, he mistakenly assumes she despises him. And when we come to this passage today, it's a little bit like we're in Shrek's position. And looking around at you, lovely lot, I certainly wouldn't want to suggest in any way that any of you actually resemble Shrek. But gosh, it's good to have you back, Dan, and that's a fetching colour of green you are wearing today. We're like Shrek in that we're hearing today just a snatch of a conversation, right? That wasn't directly addressed to us, but sure sounds like it is. And to be honest, what we just heard Yvonne read doesn't sound particularly like good news, right? So we just pause a little bit longer with that image of the overheard conversation. There are actually three ways that we can risk, I think, hearing it out of context, right? Or at least we need to pay attention to three different kinds of context. So first of all, our reading just drops us right into the middle of an address that Jesus is giving to his disciples, spanning the entirety of chapter 10 of Matthew, chapter 10 of Matthew's gospel. A second context is even if we look at that whole entirety of what Jesus says in that chapter 10 discourse, what he says there is in many ways a continuation of things he's already been saying, talking about over the previous chapters of that gospel. So there's that broader story. And then the third kind of context, the broadest context, something we're always, of course, confronted with, right, when we turn to Scripture, which is simply we're living in a different place and time than when those words were originally spoken or written. So what we'll do today is look at the reading in each of those three different contexts, starting close in, and we'll sort of try and pan out so we end up somewhere more or less here and now. Okay. And over all of that discussion, there's this question that we're exploring through the kind of the sermons in this series at the moment. What does it mean to be on a mission? Do you have the next slide, please? So the first context, okay, of this particular chapter. So in this chapter, as we heard last week, Jesus has assembled his 12 chosen disciples because he's decided to send them out on a mission specifically to the lost sheep of Israel. It's a moment for specific instruction for them. He tells them where to go, how to behave in a range of scenarios. It's also time for a bit of a pep talk, right? Get everyone fizzing and enthusiastic. But you know, if we think about it, you know, how would the Hurricanes have gone last night if the coach had said to them at the start of the game, gather around, boys, right? We're sending you out like sheep among wolves. Go to it. Actually, maybe that's what the Chiefs coach said. It'll be like next time. Anyway, it's hard to imagine, right, the disciples, you know, bumping chests, you know, high-fiving, fist bumps and all that, after hearing the verses we've just heard, right? And if it doesn't sound much like a pep talk, it's not much of a health and safety briefing either, is it, right? Be as innocent as doves out there and as shrewd as snakes. So here is a time where we think, you know, maximum clarity is required. It seems like Jesus is being his most cryptic, his most proverbial in what he asks of his followers. But let's just look a little closer. Right? Let's first talk about sheep and wolves. Doesn't sound good, right? Being sent out like a sheep among wolves. When we hear this, we immediately think, you know, being vulnerable, being prey, being eaten alive. More or less how above average runs most times. But what might that message have meant for the disciples when they were hearing it? Recall that at the very start of this discourse, Jesus has instructed them to go to the lost sheep of Israel, right? And echoing in their minds might be his warning about false prophets, which you encounter back in chapter 7, so a couple of chapters earlier. He says, false prophets, they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly, they are ferocious wolves. Right. So one way we might think about this initial kind of briefing, I guess, is in this original context, maybe it's in the sense of Jesus' kind of ongoing attack on religious orthodoxy at the time. Right? Disciples being sent out as kind of true sheep among those false sheep who currently are leading the people astray. That's kind of one way we might look at it, right? Is in that more kind of narrow context. Okay. But it's, you know, it's undeniable at the same time that these wolves seem to come with a real sense of menace in these verses, right? Jesus goes on to talk about getting into some pretty intimidating situations, getting flogged and arrested, being brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. And so some of these verses must refer to later events, right? Because this particular mission briefing is designed precisely to avoid running into Gentiles. So we are getting a little bit of kind of, not mixed messages, but maybe some slightly different timing issues coming through here as well, just to add to the complications, right? But nevertheless, these verses do seem to ring true, right? As a kind of clear-eyed acknowledgement of the risks that might accompany faith, being on that mission. And if we could have the next slide. I wouldn't be surprised if this verse or ones like it were in the minds of the Early Rain Covenant Church just last Sunday. Early Rain is based in the city of Chengdu in southwestern China. Its founding pastor has been in jail there since December 2018. And on Sunday, just gone, its service, you see from the photo, was raided by more than 50 police, who rounded up more than 30 of its congregants and took them off for interrogation. And as far as I'm aware, I've been trying to sort of read a bit more. Their two leaders have not yet been released. Sending you out like sheep among wolves. For some churches, in some contexts, even today, that's a very real scenario. Amid that bleakness, that shock, right, that confronting image, our brothers and sisters in Christ, among that potential risk for danger, let's at least not overlook one more thing that would have come to mind for the disciples as Jesus spoke of sheep and wolves. And that is a messianic vision of the prophet Isaiah, which we read in chapter 11 of Isaiah, and they would have been to the fore of their mind as they're coming to terms with who this person Jesus is. The start of the chapter may be familiar, right? A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of power, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. But then a few verses later, the vision continues to unfold, this kind of messianic vision. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. For the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So even in the midst of these confronting reminders of the potential risk of your faith, we don't want to forget that being sheep among wolves carries with it a sense of radical hope and possibility in this verse that we're reading, as an image of establishing God's reign. Paradoxically, surprisingly, yet it's there. Okay. Let's leave those wolves for a moment, though, and then move on to the next sentence, where we confront a couple more members of the animal kingdom. Be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. It's like a deliberately confronting paradox right there, or an oxymoron, bringing together two things that seem completely opposed. Right? But just like with those parables that Jesus has this habit of telling, we see him here reaching for those images of everyday life, familiar things, from the world of his audience, to try and explain something less immediately tangible about God's reality. With doves and snakes, I mean, your guess is as good as mine, right? But like, I think the reference to doves makes some immediate sense, because the law specifies that you can take a dove and offer it for absolution, the temple, if you can't afford a lamb. So there's an image there of an animal able to kind of be pure and be, it kind of has that kind of resonance with its audience, right? Of purity and of innocence. But there's something shocking about a snake, right? Especially right next to an innocent little dove. Because, of course, the snake has that starring role, doesn't it, in the fall and the expulsion from Eden. Right from that early story, the snake is described as crafty. So that means we need to think about the qualities being ascribed to these two animals. What does it mean to be innocent? What does it mean to be shrewd? The Greek word being used here for innocent means being pure or unmixed. A lot of Bible translations use the word harmless. The Amplified Bible glosses it as having no self-serving agenda. Doesn't seem to mean being simple, foolish or naive, but pure or unmixed. Likewise, the Greek word for shrewd means being thoughtful or wise or prudent. Doesn't mean being scheming or manipulative, it seems. The same word used here in our verse and is translated as shrewd, the same word is translated as wise in a very famous story Jesus told just earlier in the Gospel. It says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine, puts them into practice, is like a wise or a shrewd man who builds his house on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who builds his house on sand. So I think it's helpful to have those definitions in mind, because they're focused not so much, I think, on the potential threats that those disciples might be facing when they go out, right? But focus more on their relationship with the message that motivates their mission, right? Being shrewd and innocent is about their relation to the message that they're carrying. And that insight hopefully prompts us to broaden our focus a little bit then and think about what that mission might be. So we can have the next slide. We're going to step to our second context, right? Broadening out to that Gospel of Matthew. Okay. So across the first half of Matthew, right up to today's reading, we see a message being passed on, or rather the message being passed on. So first, beginning of chapter 3, before Jesus even begins his ministry, we read, in those days John the Baptist came, preaching in the wilderness of Judea, and saying, repent. the kingdom of heaven has come near. And then John gets put in prison, and Jesus steps up, takes up that call, as you read in chapter 4, verse 17. From that time on, Jesus began to preach, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." And then Jesus delivers the Sermon on the Mount, where he lays out most fully what the message is. We read right at the start of chapter 5. Jesus saw the crowds, and he went up onto a mountainside, and he sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. And he said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then we get to our chapter, chapter 10. Jesus again gathers his 12 disciples around him, gives them authority, prepares to send them out to the people of Israel, in an echo, right, of the way the 12 tribes once entered the promised land. And he says, "As you go, proclaim this message. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you have received, freely you give." So in other words, when we think about the call to mission in these verses, I think we need to think about this thing that keeps being referred to as the kingdom of heaven. Now, I'm a very simple man, and this seems like a really big thing to me, but the way I've been trying to understand this thing that Jesus calls the kingdom of heaven is it feels to me like it's where we see God's values being expressed, being put into action. Some people call it God's economy. And as plenty of people have pointed out, God's sense of value doesn't seem to make a lot of rational sense. It's not how the world works. It's not exactly the way to power and prestige, right? In fact, the kingdom of heaven seems completely uninterested in or unimpressed by such things. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the peacemakers. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. You cannot serve both God and money. Do not judge, or you will be judged. That's the message these disciples have been called on here by Jesus to proclaim in opposition to the kingdom of this world. But the other thing I think we need to bear in mind about this kingdom of heaven is its location. And I find this also really hard to explain, so please bear with me for this, right? What I'm trying to get at, I think, is it wasn't the case, it seems, of just living in one kingdom or the other. What I mean by that, right, is although Jesus and then the disciples preached the kingdom of heaven's come near, and people heard them and believed and they found their lives transformed, it wasn't for them that the Roman Empire went away suddenly, right? Or they just got to opt out of life as it was carrying on around them. They still had to live those ordinary everyday lives in the midst of their world, even as Jesus presents this new way to see that world and themselves with new eyes. That's what I'm trying to say about location. Like, across Matthew's gospel, it feels like we're getting a sense of how these two contrasting kingdoms kind of intersect or overlap. Right? On the one hand, right, back when Jesus is tested in the wilderness, he's offered all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. And he says, "No. Worship the Lord your God and serve him only." So no kingdoms. But on the other hand, a little bit later on, the Pharisees turn up and ask him about paying taxes. And he says, "Yes, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." And it's that sense of overlapping kingdoms and the tension between them that I think we also live in as believers. And I want us to sort of take that sense of tension and of overlapping kingdoms and how the kingdom of heaven pops up in surprising places amidst the world we live in and the world that we generally value and appreciate, right? And we want to take that kind of tension into the final kind of part of the reflection here of needing to be a citizen yet not bowing down. Okay, so just the last slide, please. Thank you. So what does this mean for us? Like, we're clearly not living under Roman rule, right? We enjoyed democratic freedoms, all sorts of privileges and opportunities that would have been unimaginable to the disciples. And that's, you know, that's kind of just our good luck, right? Not by a particular design. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if Jesus or his disciples turned up in our midst today, in this kingdom we live in, I don't think they would find it entirely unfamiliar based on the kind of things that we've been seen, we've seen concerned with, those kingdom of heaven values, right? I feel they might look at us and say something like, you know, and this is just my thoughts, right? I think they might look at us and say, well, you know, the people in your society, they seem determined to value everything and everyone only in dollars. And they might look at us and say, well, the people in your society seem to think often that the only way you can rise is if you trample down others or belittle them or denigrate them. They might say something like, you guys are really keen to call yourself followers, but who are you following? There may be many other things they would say, right? But whatever Jesus or the disciples, if they turned up and talked to us about these things, whatever they would say, they'd be saying it with compassion, right? As they said, with compassion in this chapter, we're told Jesus had compassion for the crowds because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. But so as we're equally like them living in this situation, two kingdoms at once, right? What does it mean to be charged with that mission to declare the kingdom? Sorry, declare the kingdom of heaven has come near this place where we live. Today's reading calls us to be witnesses in our society to that different set of values and priorities that define the kingdom of heaven. And to do that effectively, it calls us to be both innocent and wise. That is, to be wholehearted in our desire to know and live by God's values. The value of, that lies in being meek and merciful and peacemakers, resisting the urge to treat others as enemies, resisting the urge to judge others. These are things that enable us to flourish most fully. Despite the world around us, for all its goodness, sending so many signals that this is not the case. But crucially, of course, these values aren't just built on our own strength or determination, but they stem from a God who loves us and loves the whole of his creation. So how are we called to be witnesses? I think my sense is that we need to recognize that the kingdom of the world that we're in and the kingdom of heaven will overlap for each of us a bit differently, depending on who we are and where we are, right? Things like our age, employment status, interests, culture, gender, all these things will mean that we're working this out in our own lives in different kinds of ways, right? But whoever we are, I think it will most often involve things that are incredibly ordinary and everyday. These disciples are ordinary people, and they're talking about ordinary things. Right? And by ordinary and everyday, I mean things that we do and say to those around us, things we don't do and say as well. Right? And so here's three very brief, simple examples from my life, thought of very at the last minute when I realized I didn't have many personal applications in the talk. But, you know, like that's the reality, though, is, you know, in our lives, in our particular context, what does it mean to say the kingdom is coming near? How does that transform our actions? Right. Three. One, so I work as a university teacher. Right. When I first began there, it was normal that when students submit work late, they get penalised, they lose some marks. You know, shame on you, you late student. And I went along with that, right? But over time, I've decided I'm just not going to do that to my students. I'm just not interested in doing that to them. Whatever else is going on, whatever reason, do not judge, or I too will be judged, right? Plenty of things that I'm late on in my life. So, right, so there's one. Two, just like, this is the most basic. Yesterday, pulling the car out of the driveway, head off on whatever mission I want to go on, right, in my life. There's a guy walking down the pavement carrying a box from the market nearby. So, could stand my ground, wait for the traffic gap, because, you know, that's the most important thing. I thought, who cares? So I just gave my ground, let the guy walk by. And as he walked by, I got a big thumbs up. So that was mercy from my part, not much, but if it was, I certainly felt blessed, right? It's a really small thing. Third one, a couple of weeks ago, a few houses down from us, a wheelie bin got knocked over on rubbish day, spilled out all over the road. All the rubbish just lay on the road, lay there. Yeah. And so the night before rubbish was next collected, I went down there, I collected it all up, and it was raining, because I had this wretched sermon on my mind, and these verses in my head. I just felt like, in the end, someone in our street had to humble themselves enough to just deal with this. Unfortunately, it was probably me, right? And it's not, hopefully no one even saw me, right? And I'm not telling you because I want to say, like, it's a great thing, but just, like, it's an ordinary thing where I just felt compelled, like, in the end, the kingdom of heaven is intersecting in a random way with the everyday life around me, and that was one way I felt called to not just follow the rules of the world around me, which is to just live for someone else. Just a small thing, right? So I guess what I'm saying to wrap up with my final paragraph, it's okay, as we open all the areas of our lives to God's values and we keep trying to open them up, and as we allow God's values to override our instincts and our knee-jerk reactions and the reductive ways that our world insists that we value and devalue people, then I think we find and keep finding the kingdom of heaven is just waiting to be revealed in everything we turn our hands to. And if you miss a chance to do it today, don't worry. You'll have plenty more chances tomorrow.
Cool, thank you.